This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. With the traditional Labor Day start of the general campaign, much has been made about the political polarization that our country has undergone and continues to experience. According to the Pew Research Center, Democrats and Republicans are more mistrustful of each other, and true political independents can't stand either party. What are the causes of this polarization? Is it just the leaders within the parties, or is it us, the average citizen? One researcher who looked into this question joins us today. Bill Bishop is the author of The Big Sort: Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart, which was published back in 2008 during another politically divisive election cycle. Bishop wrote his book with Robert Cushing, a retired sociologist at the University of Texas at Austin, and looked at demographic data that revealed Americans were sorting themselves into like-minded communities over the past 30 years. He joins us from Texas. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
And also to talk about polarization, and particularly North Carolina and its politics, is the director of the Elon University poll, Dr. Jason Husser. Jason is an assistant professor of political science and policy studies, where he researches on American political behavior and survey methodology. Welcome, Jason.
Welcome. Glad to be here.
Are you experiencing polarization when you talk to your friends, or do they all agree with you? How do you see the country and the state in terms of the level of polarization? You can join our conversation for the hour by sending us an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can find us on Twitter at Charlotte Talks, or join us on Facebook. Bill, when you wrote The Big Sort 8 years ago, were you at first surprised at the level of polarization, and how did you go about measuring polarization?
Well, when Bob Cushing and I got into this, we were trying to figure out why certain areas in the United States were doing better than others economically. And what we saw was that people were separating. People with BA degrees were going in one direction. People without BA degrees were going in another direction. Patents were increasingly concentrated in particular places. And so Bob thought one night, well, what the heck? Maybe this is, has something to do with politics too. Maybe we're sorting politically. And what he could, the first run at the data showed that, from 1980 to 2000, tech communities, the communities that are producing the most technology in the United States and the most patents, were getting increasingly Democratic over time. And starting from a time in 1980 when there were all the metro areas were about the same, and non-tech areas were getting increasingly Republican. And so we extended that, and we looked at all counties over a longer period of time, and what we could see was that Democratic votes were concentrating in some counties, and Republican votes were concentrating in other counties, and two-thirds of U.S. counties were getting increasingly either Republican or Democratic.
Okay. Jason, how, from a political scientist's point of view, how would you understand what polarization is?
Well, the simple definition is that polarization is movement towards the poles of a distribution. The problem with that definition is that we often want to think of polarization as a dichotomous concept. Are we polarized, yes or no? In truth, polarization is more of a continuous concept. It's more of, is a person tall or short? That's not necessarily a yes or no question, rather there's shades of tallness in between. And that's what we're seeing today in terms of polarization. Not necessarily that we're clearly polarized on the most extreme definitions of polarization, but it's certainly looking like we're more polarized than we have been in past years.
And we've certainly seen polarization in our nation's past, the founding days of the Republic and the battle over a centralized federal government to keeping power in the states, the Civil War, the late 1960s with the turmoil over civil rights and the war in Vietnam. What makes this era of polarization any different, Bill?
One thing that makes it different is that politics is now tied up with ways of life, and we choose ways of life that have a political answer to them. We never thought that people were moving. I used to live in a little 99% Democratic neighborhood in Austin, Texas, and people were moving there for a lifestyle. They wanted to be near a coffee shop, and they liked their houses close together. If you ask people whether they like to live close to other people or not, Republicans will choose the house with a lot of area around it, and Democrats will choose the house that has a neighbor close by. And it's those lifestyle choices that are leading, I believe, to the geographic polarization. And I think that also we these days are in the process, we have the daily job of defining ourselves. And politics has become a way to identify ourselves in a world where identity is quite fluid. And those things, I think, are new.
Jason, are you seeing that reflected in what you get in terms of the data for the Elon poll?
We see that in poll data both in North Carolina and nationally, as well as, importantly, in elite voting behavior. I'm talking about how polarization is different today. It's different both in part that we have more opportunities to sort ourselves in common day-to-day life, but also the intensity of polarization is different. So if we just look at the U.S. Senate, and we take the percentage of moderates based on their voting record. So we go right after the Civil War in about 1879, we see that about 32% of senators were moderate. That was actually one of the more polarized points in American history. That rose, that level of moderates rose up into the 40s, which we saw over 80% of U.S. senators were moderates. This is a time where people thought a lot of legislation was happening. Now today, we see that fewer than 10% of U.S. senators are moderates. So we are in many ways, at least at the congressional level, more polarized than we have been since the Civil War. And that's also increasingly reflected in public opinion polls, both in North Carolina as well as the nation as a whole.
Jason, you brought up the point of that we have the ability now to sort ourselves. Let me start with you. What factors would you point to in terms of this ability to sort ourselves?
For one thing, we have easy access to mass transportation that may not have been present in past years. So it's much easier to move just simply given technology. It's also easier to reflect our choices in consumer behavior. We have more choices as financial consumers than we've ever had in the past, and that allows people to make all sorts of other choices. We've also seen the, I wouldn't say collapse, but decline of the power of some social institutions such as churches, which then allows people to, in a sense, make more choices that these choices can better reflect their politics than in the past.
Bill, how would you see it?
Yeah, I think the churches is a good example. I mean, you know, I mean, Dr. King said that Sunday morning was the most segregated time in the United States, and he meant that racially, but now we can say that that's political. I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, and, you know, there are two Episcopal churches there that were about the same when I grew up, and now one is swerved off to the left and one is swerved off to the right, and people make a choice. They know when they go to a church what sort of, and they're looking for their like-minded others, and that ends up making Sunday morning one of the most segregated times politically in the United States.
And what do we know, Jason? I know you've done research on religion and politics. What do we know about those who perhaps identify with one particular faith or denomination versus others in terms of the partisan and political aspects?
Well, we have seen that white evangelical churches in particular have been at the forefront of both culture wars and polarization, and it's perhaps not surprising that they are the most susceptible to be sorted themselves based on politics. So some of my research has shown that Republicans tend to intensify their attendance within white evangelical churches, but Democrats tend to drop out of these white evangelical churches. I have not found that this applies to Catholics or African-American Protestant churches, but white evangelical churches, which compose a great deal of the American electorate, have shifted politically in ways that have been both good for the church and boosting attendance among certain groups, but bad for these churches in other ways by lowering attendance among Democrats.
Bill, do you see this playing out nationally as well in terms of the religious aspect and the further polarization going on in the sorting?
Well, I think if you continue what Jason was saying, and so Democrats are less likely to go to church because going to church identifies one, at least in recent times, as being a Republican. And so, as people tend to their identities, they are less willing to. If you're a good Democrat, you don't want to tell your neighbors, "Oh yeah, Sunday I can't, I can't go play golf. I got to go, I go to church," because that would mark you as something other than a good Democrat. And if you just replicate that a million times across the country, then you see what kind of situation we're in. And it, a lot of times it has, it has little to do with Trump or Clinton. It has to do with how we identify ourselves.
Okay. When you wrote The Big Sort 8 years ago, you said that in 2004, in a very close presidential contest, that nearly half of the voters lived in a community where the election wasn't close at all. You called them landslide counties. Have we seen this trend continue in 2008 and 2012?
Yes. The percentage went up. It's around 54% in 2012, and then we looked at the 2014 congressional elections, which aren't exactly the same thing, but in the congressional elections, I think almost two-thirds of voters lived in a county where in their congressional election the results were 60-40 one way or another.
So more and more Americans are associating themselves or living in communities that they basically only know others who act like them. What kind of effect is that having on the politics and society in general?
Well, the social psychologist we talked to for the book said that there were two. The research is that like-minded groups over time tend to become more extreme in the way that they're like-minded. So if you put a bunch of Democrats in a room and have them talk about the issues of the day, the group will become more liberal over time, and Republicans do the same thing, except they become more conservative over time. And the social psychologists say that there are two things at work. One, if you're around a group of people who think alike, you tend to hear only one argument. The other thing is that as you're a good member of a group, you want to be a good member of a group, and so you tend to be a little bit more extreme in the way the group is alike. So in my old neighborhood in Austin, it wasn't good enough to vote against Bush. You had to put an impeach Bush sticker on your car, or to show that you're a good member of the group. You become slightly more extreme, and over time, that process then pushes the group towards the poll.
Okay. That's Bill Bishop, the author of The Big Sort, and we're talking about political polarization in the United States and how that is playing out in our country, along with Jason Husser, who is the assistant professor of political science at Elon University and director of the Elon Poll. If you have questions about this polarization going on in our country and in our state, please feel free to send us an email at charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can send us a tweet at Charlotte Talks or find us on Facebook. We'll be back shortly with our conversation.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Honda of Concord, committed to customer service, satisfaction, and bringing excellence to the car buying experience. Offering a selection of over 700 new and pre-owned vehicles, details at hondaofconcord.com. Tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, a conversation with columnist Heather Havrileski. For over a decade, this North Carolina native has been giving advice to the heartsick and emotionally lost and confused. She's the author of a weekly advice column called Ask Polly, which is featured in New York Magazine, and she's now the author of a new book called How to Be a Person in the World. Her advice is funny, smart, and geared toward those who may or may not be experiencing some sort of existential crisis. We talk about her advice style, her new book, and more with guest host Sarah D'Elia tomorrow morning on Charlotte Talks at 9 here on 90.7 WFAE.
Thank you. On the next Diane Rehm Show, focus has been on the presidential election, but heated congressional races in states like Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Florida are also underway. As Republicans look to hold on to Congress this fall, key races and the prospects for a change of control in the Senate and even the House.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-supported 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking about the state of our disunion with Dr. Jason Husser, director of the Elon University Poll, and Bill Bishop, author of the book The Big Sort, to try and understand why we have become so polarized in our politics. Do you feel we are as polarized as some folks make it out to be? Can you have civil conversations with folks from the opposing partisan camp? You can join our conversation by sending us an email to charlottetalks@WFAE or send us a tweet at Charlotte Talks or leave us a comment on Facebook. One of the notable critics of describing our society as polarized is Morris Fiorina, a political science professor at Stanford, who wrote The Culture War, A Myth of Polarized America, and argues that just because voters have sorted themselves into political parties doesn't mean that we are necessarily polarized because the center is still holding in politics. Bill, let me start with you. How do you view that argument?
Oh, I was going to let Jason handle all the more sphere. You all are the political scientists. This is a political scientist food fight, and so I think you all ought to get his criticism of the sorting was that, well, if you look at voter registration figures, then you still have a lot of independents. And, you know, I don't, most states, half the states don't have voter registration. And it seems like it's more important to look at what people do rather than what they say they think about themselves. So, you know, I've lived in a 70% Republican county now and from a 99%, Democratic neighborhood in Austin, and I can tell you it's different. You know, just you open your eyes.
Jason, how would you respond to that argument?
Much of the debate among political scientists about polarization and whether or not the mass public is polarized is largely based on what operational definition we end up using. You could use a definition which would argue that polarization only exists in which there's almost no middle ground. So if we thought of two overlapping distributions, a blue distribution for Democrats, a red distribution for Republicans, there'd be almost no purple in the center. And if that's the definition that we're going to use, then we're not truly polarized. There's still a great purple area in the middle of the country. But that shifts depending upon which citizens you're talking about. So if you're talking about folks that are politically engaged, those folks that tend to participate in politics, tend to know about politics, that purple overlapping area has almost disappeared. Now, it still makes up over 10% of the population of those who are politically engaged, but that it's rapidly falling, and it has fallen a great deal since Fiorina has made that argument. When we're talking about folks who are not engaged with politics, people who aren't voting, people who, you know, just really could care less about what's going on, those folks are still not that polarized. So among the politically engaged, we are approaching almost any definition of polarization. Among the less engaged, polarization is still not really a big of a deal.
And we know in North Carolina, and I'll direct this to Jason because it's a North Carolina specific question, but we know that the fastest growing group of registered voters is unaffiliated. Are they truly independent? Do they not like one party over the other?
Most of these folks who are registering as independents aren't truly psychologically independent. They are still breaking for one party one way or another. That said, they do tend to be a better reflection of the state as a whole than either of the two parties. But for the most part, folks who are saying that they're independents aren't exactly independents.
Okay. Melba emailed in this statement. When I moved to Charlotte in 2000, I bought a house in Matthews and almost immediately realized it was a mistake. I heard about Plaza Midwood and checked out the neighborhood in 2003. Lawns were filled with Howard Dean signs and anti-war signs. I bought a house here as soon as I could and haven't regretted it one bit that the vast majority of my neighbors think and vote like me. Bill, is this what we're coming to expect in today's American politics?
Yes, and it's what we've come to expect in the way we want to live. And I think it's important to separate out the political part with the lifestyle part. And the lifestyle part is so much more important. We have such a problem these days finding a community. There's a KIPP group and a consulting group in Brooklyn called K-Hole, and they say it used to be that people were born in a community and had to find their individuality. Today, people are born as individuals and have to find their community. And I think what the listener is describing is that attempt that we're all engaged in trying to find our community, and that success in finding the community then has these political ramifications.
Okay, someone had asked me on Facebook when I posted about this particular show that we're doing. He asked, "To what extent is our current polarization due to the relative lack of involvement on the part of the voting population? If non-voters did get out to cast ballots, would it make a difference?" Jason, I'll start with you on that question.
This is a difficult thing about polarization, that it seems like it's due to lack of participation, but in fact, the folks who are most likely to participate, most likely to pay attention to politics, are also the most polarized. And at the same time, it does appear that polarization has led to deeper political engagement than we've had in the past. In some ways, polarization is good for political knowledge, good for political engagement, though it can be bad for the basic fibers of society.
Yeah, I mean, Diana Mutz at the University of Pennsylvania sort of half-jokingly says, you know, maybe we need people to be a little less engaged, So we don't allow our elected representatives to compromise, but that's their job. We don't allow them to kind of do the dirty work of politics, because we're so on their backs about maintaining our point of view that they can't do what they need to do.
And some people will lay this at the feet of gerrymandering as well, in terms of the level of polarization. Is that necessarily the case, or is gerrymandering a kind of symptom of what we have developed in terms of this fever of polarization?
I personally see gerrymandering as more symptomatic than causal. Now, gerrymandering is not something I'm advocating as a good thing, but we could point to a number of bigger factors going on in Congress that's led to polarization. So, for instance, changes in how committee leaders were assigned in Congress, the rise of strong party whips, changes in how the Congressional Work Week and internal culture happens are all probably much greater causes of congressional polarization than gerrymandering alone would be.
I'm with Jason. We want to look at someone who's done something bad to us. You know, we want to find a conspiracy, and when in fact, I just read a paper yesterday about Florida, and the political scientists get your computers going, and Democrats have so packed themselves in Florida in the major cities that there was practically no way to design districts that were balanced politically. It's what we've done to ourselves rather than something someone else has done to us.
Well, Bill, you talked about in the Big Sort, you talked on a chapter about lifestyle, and that in particularly Democrats were attracted to the urban life, to the things like having public transportation, having bookstores, coffee shops, while Republicans wanted kind of the freedom of the range and in rural areas. North Carolina has been experiencing, and a lot of commentators have been talking about, the great divide between rural and urban areas of the state. Is that a kind of symptom that you're seeing play out nationally as well?
Well, I think it's more urban and rural is easy. I mean, only 33% of North Carolina is 33% of the population lives in a rural county. So if there's only urban-rural, then you'd have a Democratic state. When we looked at the 2014 congressional elections, in 9 county types that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has designed to look at the most urban counties all the way to the most rural. Democrats won only the counties that were in metropolitan areas of 1 million or more. They lost significantly in every other county type. So it's not just rural versus urban, it's Democrats, and this is what the political scientists found in Florida. Democrats are packed into the counties that make up the most urban metro areas in the United States.
Okay. Maggie emailed into the show. She says, I must disagree with the comment that Dems aren't going to church because, quote, church is considered a Republican identity. Not true of most churches I know outside of evangelical identity. Christian Democrats do exist and flourish. Jason, are we seeing this divide happening within churches as well?
Well, it's important to note this caveat about church sorting, is that most of this is happening within white evangelical churches. So these are, the biggest denomination would be white Southern Baptist churches. So it's not necessarily applying to liberal Baptists or Presbyterians, Episcopalians, or Catholics. That said, there are motions going on within churches that are leading Democrats to attend far less often among these white evangelical churches.
Well, the mainlines are splitting too. I mean, you have Episcopal entire dioceses of the Episcopal Church dropping out and going with an Anglican communion that is has a more right wing point of view. People know the liberal Presbyterian Church from the conservative Pres. So there's not necessarily a split. There are splits within denominations. But also within denominations, people know which church to go to that reflects their point of view. I mean, the President Obama goes to the United Church of Christ, right? So, I mean, that which is one of the most liberal denominations going. So even within mainline denominations, people really do know and seek out churches that reflect their point of view.
Okay. In this summer's Pew Research Center poll on this polarization, one of the major reasons that people identify with their party, the research found, is a negative feeling towards the opposition or to the opposing party. And we have two political candidates that have generated such negative feelings between Hillary Clinton. Oftentimes her disapproval or negative ratings will be in the high 50s. Donald Trump is in 62%. Is this just going to exacerbate what we tend to see if people are saying, I don't like the other party more than I like my own party, so I'm going to vote against them? Is this just continuing to hammer this sorting and this level of polarization?
When I think of polarization, I think of it in some ways like a complex weather phenomenon, like a hurricane. So it might be that one individual current, say Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, could contribute to that and may make a difference in a Category 4 or a Category 3. But the weather system and the phenomena of polarization is much bigger than one individual person or one individual candidate. And to really understand polarization, we have to look at it at a much more institutional or structural level.
Okay. Bill?
Or looking at it at a more personal level, and you see an increasing percentage of people who don't want their sons or daughters to marry someone from a different party.
So it's even embodying in terms of the actual relationships that people have on a personal level.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's where I think that polarization ends up being a vicious cycle in some ways.
Yeah.
We see feedback loops where this phenomenon may have been exacerbated or really kick-started by changes in Congress, but now it's outside of the bounds of Congress itself, and we're seeing it in marital selection, friend groups, consumer behavior, in just our everyday conversations.
Well, a commenter, a listener, Joshua, emailed in, I was curious if the research shows issues, polarization still occurs in communities with mixed political ideologies. Does research suggest that people within these politically diverse communities polarize each other in the same way politically homogeneous communities do? Or do they discuss and generally view opposing views more tolerably? Bill, how do you see if you go into a community where there isn't this level of polarization, do folks tend to get along with each other, or is it just that they separate out against each other?
Well, I don't. I have only personal experience on this because I mainly vote Democratic. I do vote Democratic, and believe me, in a 70% Republican county, Democrats know who the other Democrats are. Republicans know who the other, and they have names for their groups. They meet separately at coffee shops for discussion groups.
Do you feel like that's a kind of stealth? Do you have any Republican friends?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing that happens in a small town that is, you don't have a choice. There's research done on small high schools versus big high schools. People who go to small high schools that are less diverse on the outside, if you look at the numbers, those people tend to have more, a bigger variety of discussion mates and friends politically than people who go to a large high school, who have a choice, of which groups to affiliate with. So in a small town and in a small high school and a small college, people have a greater variety of discussion mates than people who live in big cities and go to big high schools and go to big universities.
Jason, is that a good thing for folks to interact with people from the opposite side instead of constantly getting reinforced in terms of their political views with folks they interact with on a day-to-day basis?
I think the diffusion of ideas is a good thing. Rarely does one side have all the answers, and so without these types of cross-partisan conversations, it's very difficult for people to see a broader perspective. Adding to this community and geographic-based notion, particularly in small towns, so many small towns are so racially divided so that many whites, even though you may look at the town's outcomes of their votes, it looks like they're split. A lot of these are racial divides, and so where African Americans are voting for Democrats and the whites in the town are voting for Republicans. So even though at an aggregate level it may look like some of these small towns are more evenly divided, mm-hmm. they can actually be quite polarized internally.
Okay. Stacy emailed, do issues drive polarization? For instance, I absolutely cannot compromise on pro-life issues, but I can use judgment and compromise on issues like border control or immigration. How much do issues play into this polarization?
Jason?
I would add that issues are both the reason we have polarization, but issues themselves and the way we think of them emerge differently by polarization. So when I often think of polarization, I think of issues having a few characteristics. One, that they're deeply felt. Pro-life, pro-choice issues are certainly one of those. That groups are significantly different on the issues, that the issues are broadly salient, a lot of people are thinking about them, and that these differences must feel irreconcilable.
Okay.
It doesn't necessarily mean that they are, they just need to feel that way.
We'll pick up on that point. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nexen Pruitt, over 190 lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court and at the deal table from Charlotte and seven other Carolina locations. Next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. Coming up in 20 minutes on the Diane Reem Show, the focus this year has been on the presidential election, but there are heated congressional races in states such as Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Florida. And as Republicans look to hold on to control of Congress this fall, key races and the prospects for a change of control in the Senate and even the House will be the focus of the conversation of the Diane Reem Show coming up at 10 o'clock here on 90.7 WFAE. If you'd like to join our conversation on polarization in politics, email us, charlottetalks at WFAE, or reach us on Facebook on the WFAE page or on Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
America's first offshore wind farm. Some think it will be a noisy eyesore, and others think it's the way forward.
this is energy we can live with. I think we're seeing an energy revolution in the making. I'm a sailor, and the winds off Long Island are virtually always blowing.
I'm Molly Wood, offshore wind power, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6:30, following All Things Considered on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking about polarization and the sorting of America with Bill Bishop, author of the book The Big Sort, and Dr. Jason Husser, director of the Elon University poll, to try and understand how we have become sorted and polarized in our politics. Jason, you were talking about issues and how that may play into this kind of polarization. In the Pew report on partisanship and political animosity, they asked the question among Republicans and among Democrats, the reasons why you identify with one party. And for both parties, a significant majority among Republicans said 68% said that Democratic policies were bad for the country. Among Democrats, 62% said Republican policies were bad for the country. Is this surprising that we have gotten into the depths of issues and this kind of polarization playing out there as well?
Important part of polarization, but in many ways, the way we think about issues are colored by polarization itself. It's much like we could critique Tom Brady or Cam Newton. You could say, well, I choose the Patriots because I think Tom Brady is better at these things than Cam Newton over the Panthers. But the real story is you probably picked a team and then you start picking issues that fit your team's line. So in many ways, partisanship is heritable, that we are socialized into it by our parents, and then we then pick the issues that fit that partisanship rather than the other way around.
Does education play a role in this sorting process?
Does Bill want to take that?
Bill?
Well, I think a lot of the research is that the more educated you are, the more adept you are at doing exactly what Jason described, is tailoring the facts of the situation to your pre-existing partisan belief. So, yeah, the more educated you are, the better you are at using the daily news and what you see on TV and in the newspaper to reinforce what you already think.
We see that through talking about an issue in particular is privacy related to government surveillance. So after 9/11 with the Patriot Act, Democrats were very opposed to government surveillance. That opposition was a lot less when it was a Democratic president doing it with PRISM.
It is, along with education and religion, we've talked a great deal, and family connections. What's the role of social media playing in terms of this partisan divide and how people view each other?
Gosh, I mean, it just, choice allows you to, the more choice you have, the more likely you are to choose to be among people who reinforce what you think. And social media is all about choice and all about tailoring, what's in front of your eyeballs to reinforce what you think, to make yourself feel better. So, you know, it's perfect. It's the media of our time.
I think of social media in some ways the way I think of soft news. So we think of soft news like late night shows where folks are actually going for comedy or entertainment value but happen to pick up political information. The consequence of this is that people who might not otherwise be, you know, reading hard news like, you know, the New York Times or NPR or the Washington Post, they do catch it on Colbert or other late night shows. Social media is an extension of that in the sense that it can bring political information to people who wouldn't otherwise have it, but it does lead to new opportunities, historically new opportunities, for people to sort themselves. One interesting thing about social media today is this concept of unfriending people and tuning out of folks who disagree with people politically. Mm-hmm. That seems like it could be quite dangerous because people who do that will simply lose the information and they'll only hear one side. What some early research that has recently come out in published journals has shown is that people who are dropping out and unfriending people and are tuning out because of it are actually quite informed and are getting that information otherwise. That social media, in all its nastiness, is still reaching sort of those folks in the middle who may be tuned out of politics and potentially leading to further political knowledge in those groups.
Okay. Peter emailed in and asked the question, how much does the success of political wedge issues, like here in North Carolina with HB2, push people further from reconciliation or at least interaction, like supporters of HB2 being labeled bigots? Jason, what do you find that with the kind of polarizing issue that HB2 has become in your surveys, are you finding a common thread here in your work?
We see both the Elon poll about HB2 as well as other surveys of HB2 that this is a highly polarized issue. There's no surprise there. But it's important to take into context with HB2 and other issues, we'll call them wedge issues, that these are in some ways manufactured issues by political parties. I'm not saying HB2 is not a real thing that affects a lot of people's lives, but the reason it does get a certain level of salience is because some parties decided that this is something that people can be divided on, whereas there may be more consensus on other issues that don't allow these parties to differentiate themselves.
So, Bill, are political parties to blame for continuing to push folks apart with the way that they approach or frame a particular issue? And it's not just about HB2. It seems to be about every issue, particularly in this year's presidential campaign.
Well, this is where I think Jason's concept of the self-reinforcing loops is important. I mean, did the rise of Fox and MSNBC create the polarization, or is it merely reacting to a market? And it's both, right? And so I don't, you know, parties are doing what parties do, which is try to win elections, and media does what the media does, which is try to gain market share, and those things are working in this environment to both create more polarization, and where it starts, you know, I don't know.
Well, let me ask this question then: where does it end? How would you, if you had the magic wand, what would you do to try and address this issue of polarization, or is this just a fact of our lives nowadays?
To me, it's a fact of life, and you know, maybe the particular polarization, I think political scientists will say that there'll be some issue that will come in that won't have a natural left or right, Democratic or Republican home, and that those sorts of issues then begin to break down those polls that have been created. And maybe it's a candidate, maybe it's a Trump that begins to break down what it means to be a Republican and what it means to be a Democrat. So, yeah, nothing lasts forever, but how it ends, I don't know.
I wonder if some ways if polarization isn't sort of the natural state of the American political system, that we saw a period of less polarization really from the 1930s until the 80s, early 90s. But that may have been the outlier. So in some ways, when we're talking about polarization, we might be talking about the rule, not the exception.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jason, mm-hmm. back in 2013, you wrote a column when Congress was nearing the fiscal cliff, and you had some suggestions about a potential way to address this issue. You talked about resisting the us versus them mentality, being skeptical of simple solutions to complex problems, accept our two-party system, and think beyond campaigns. Has anything changed since you wrote that piece 3 years ago to say maybe we need to think about this, or what's the realistic possibility of these particular approaches?
One thing that I was thinking a lot about in 2013 was that we couldn't ever see institutional change within Congress, that the parties themselves were never going to do anything to change how Congress worked. I think probably the easiest solution for polarization, not a true solution, but alleviating point, may be to look at how congressional committees are operated in such a way that could allow more bipartisan legislation to get through, that things aren't quite as obstructionist within Congress. I do think it's important that we as individual citizens avoid this in-group and out-group social identity behavior, which really is really destructive in some ways. But if we could just point to one institutional thing that may make a difference, it's probably figuring out how do we tweak some fairly minor rules within Congress to allow more legislation with bipartisan support to get through.
Bill, do you see folks willing to talk to those from the opposite party and willing to understand and try and recognize where they're coming from?
Honestly, no.
Okay.
I mean,
so basically we're going to be stuck with this situation for the foreseeable future.
I think a partisan realignment of the type that we haven't seen in a long time could make a difference. I'm not sure that it would, but you could see a situation in which one of the parties displaced the other party and then eventually another one emerged, and that led to some realignment of the broad coalitions. That could lead to some changes in polarization. But if we do have some deeper structural things, perhaps within our national fabric itself, that leads to polarization, I don't know if there's a simple solution. But in many ways, it's learning to deal with a system that is polarized as much as trying to end polarization itself.
Okay. Ben emails, with only two parties, what other alternative is there other than to polarize? In a culture where winning and losing is how we conduct most of our lives, being a part of a team seems the natural order of things. And we've heard oftentimes, and we continue to hear in this year's election even, about third parties, about the libertarians, about the green parties. What about, is there a possibility of the creation of a kind of moderate middle of the road political party that could help to bridge some of this divide?
Michael Bloomberg certainly didn't seem to think so in this election cycle, or we'd probably be talking about a three-party race for president right now. Without really changing the Constitution itself and how we conduct elections, I'm not optimistic of the rise of third party simply because of Duviger's law that two-party or single-member district first-past-the-post systems tend to lead to two parties. So without really constitutional change, I don't anticipate a sustainable third party emerging.
Okay. And we know that independents, particularly, you know, the fastest growing group, Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, most independents tend to lean one way or the other, to one party over the other, right?
Yes. And in fact, I pulled up these numbers in North Carolina after our previous conversation, and actually only 10% of independents in North Carolina, or 10% of voters, are actually true independents. So if we looked at independents as a whole, yes, it does look like the largest political group in the state. However, there are more independent-leaning Democrats than true independents. There are also more independent-leaning Republicans than true independents. True independents are only about 1 in 10 voters.
Okay.
And you can see how that works. I mean, and at the same time, straight ticket voting has increased. And you could see how that worked here in my county in Texas. That long time Democratic county judge was visited by Republicans who said, you know, change parties or we're going to run somebody. And since only, you know, 20-30% of the votes in the county are split tickets, we're going to beat you. And so we changed parties, and so national politics becomes local, and the process of polarization increases.
So, in going into this year's election, with the presidential campaign really driving a lot of the attention, but in particularly looking at some competitive down ballot, Jason, how do you see? Do you see this notion of potential split ticket voting reoccurring again, or are people going to be locked into, once they get that ballot, just basically voting straight ticket, even though they can't do that in North Carolina with one punch, going down the ballot and voting with their party for all offices down the ballot?
Well, I have a poll in the field next week in which I'm going to ask open-ended questions to split-ticket voters about why they plan to do that. I still don't anticipate split-ticket voting to be a huge phenomenon, but given the fissures within the Republican Party caused by Trump's nomination and opposition to Trump, I could see split-ticket voting, in a sense, to allow McCrory or Burr to do better than Trump in the state.
Okay. In the Pew Research poll, most Republicans and Democrats want compromise, but they want it on their terms. The report said that majorities of Democrats, 62%, and Republicans, 58%, say their party should get more of what it wants on key issues facing the nation. Where is the basic definition of compromise in this system, or is there any understanding of what compromise is?
Welcome to America, right?
but the system is designed to instill this notion of compromise, isn't it, Jason?
It is supposed to be sort of an American value, where this comes up a bigger deal to me are in congressional primaries, where candidates who have compromised, who have worked across the aisle, are in many ways the most vulnerable folks in their primary. So if you take gerrymandering, in which if a person wins their primary, they have a good chance of winning their general election, their real threat is losing in the primary. And so if compromise is something that voters punish in candidates, it's not going to be surprising that then they offer us policy choices that are devoid of that compromise.
Okay. And then that helps determine who runs for office to begin with. There was a professor at Colby College who interviewed people in around the country who would make good congressional candidates. They were heads of chambers of commerce or unions, and they told them, yeah, I can raise the money, I can hold my nose and I can do that, but what I don't want to do is have to become someone different than who I am in order to win the primary. And so people who are moderates, who are compromisers, are weeded out at the front end of the process that Jason describes.
So the future of what we tend to see is that both parties will continue to move to their extremes?
I don't see any patterns right now that are suggesting that polarization is going to go away anytime soon. If the Republican Party continues to perform poorly in national elections, we may see some changes within the GOP, which then reverberate throughout the Democratic Party. But right now, I don't see any major trend that leads me to be optimistic polarization is going anywhere.
Okay, that was Jason Husser of Elon University and director of the poll, along with Bill Bishop, the author of The Big Sort. We've been talking about polarization in America. Thank you both, gentlemen.